Tie me to the bed. Use the rope.
Oh, I don't want to. It's so sad.
What's so sad?
That things aren't that simple. That we're not as simple as we used to be. Or used to think we'd be. And sad, too, that tying you with this rope will only give a momentary pleasure.
Well, that seems quite good to me.
But you're a rose.
Then tie me to this fence and be a bee.
Yes, this is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, October 28th, 2010. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Kenneth Koch and his verbal circus. None of the poets in the New York School liked to be called a New York School poet, but the label stuck, and basically they were a group of very close friends of extraordinary talent. The core included Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, who's still living, and Kenneth Koch, who died in 2002. They ended up writing quite distinctly from each other, but their humor, their exuberance, and their associative acrobatics were entirely new to American poetry. We're going to listen to some Kenneth Koch poems today. I'm joined by Dean Young, a poet of great humor himself, who has learned a lesson or two from New York School of Poetry, I think it's safe to say. Dean Young is now teaching at the University of Texas in Austin. Dean, when did you first read Kenneth Koch?
Oh, boy, I was quite young. I was in college, and I started by finding a book by Frank O'Hara just in a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
Then I found a book by Kenneth, Thank You and Other Poems, and which promptly changed my life.
How so?
Well, partly what you said in the introduction. There's an incredible joy and invention. You know, it's always problematic talking about poetry that is light and even funny because it seems like it's not serious.
Yeah.
And in fact, it isn't serious, but the way it's not serious is about things that, at least as a young poet, felt an obligation to be serious about, which I think, for me, made me try to fake things a little bit. It was like I was trying to write the poems of an old man, and I think we all learned that from T.S. Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
So Koch and O'Hara and Ashbery all provided me a substantial, authenticating antidote to that.
Did you know Kenneth Koch personally?
Yes, I did.
How so? How did you meet him, and how did you know him?
Well, my friend Mark Holliday sent Kenneth one of my books. I can't remember which one it was. It was an early book. And he gave me Kenneth's address and said, look, you know, time is running out for all of us. You should tell people if their work means something to you. So I got my nerve up and wrote Kenneth a fan letter, and I sent him a leaf.
A leaf?
Yeah, a leaf. It was fall.
Uh-huh.
A particularly nice leaf, and you know, which he later thanked me for very much. And so that began a kind of communication. And I was teaching at Loyola of Chicago at that time, and we had him come in and read. Somebody else picked him up at the airport, and I was sitting in my office, and he was walking down the hall. And, you know, naturally, I was very, very nervous. And I stood up, and I said, Mr. Kokitz, and he just said, Dean, get over it. And that was sort of the ongoing tenor of our relationship, which I didn't see him that much. We'd usually see each other two, maybe if I was lucky, three times a year. Sometimes he'd call me up out of the blue just to make fun of me.
Oh, man. Well, I actually had an opportunity to meet him. I worked with him very, very briefly a year or two before he died. And because I produced for radio a handful of his 1,000 avant-garde plays, which, as you know, are these miniature, mostly one-page plays. There's not 1,000 of them. There's more like 100 of them in a book. And that's what we heard at the top of the show. That one was called In the Storm of Love. And I want to play another one for you, mainly because it's based on one of his most famous poems, most popular poems, really. And it's a good example of how he was never afraid of being silly and over the top.
Right.
It's called Permanently, and Koch himself introduced it.
The scene is a city sidewalk and a street. Parents and children are making comments on the actions of some parts of speech.
The nouns are clustered in the street.
An adjective walks past. Oh, she kisses the nouns.
The principal will be in a rage.
Look, here he comes. He is indeed a tower.
Adjective! Nouns! Get back in the textbook. Otherwise, we won't include you in the next book.
But the nouns are struck, moved, changed.
I think they've fallen in love with the adjective. In any event, they say, you can't write a book of any kind without us, at least of any size. So go away. Give us our liberty today. We've seen an adjective, and all for us is changed.
Oh, look, the principal is hobbling away.
The next day.
I'm a verb. My car is at the curb, and I'm driving away. Adjective and nouns, jump in.
They've created the sentence. Come, let's read what it says. You have enchanted me with a single kiss.
Which can never be undone.
Until the destruction of language.
That was Permanently by Kenneth Cook, performed in 2001 by actors from the Barrow Group in New York City and produced for New York Public Radio. Now, Dean, that may not be his greatest poem in the world, but it does illustrate the one thing that really attracted me to him so much. Is he's infinitely charming. That poem has a lot of charm.
It does. And, you know, I was actually talking with some of my students the other day and trying to sort of nail down characteristics, almost as if we were trying to make charm into a critical term.
Uh-huh.
And there's a profound lightness of touch and a great belief in liberty, in freedom, and also the capacity of art to carry good news.
Yeah, that's one thing that's really noticeable about Kenneth Cook is that he is not a depressive poet. He doesn't focus on the negatives in life. He's not afraid of them. They come up all the time in his poetry. But he is a poet of exuberance and happiness. And there's not a lot of historical tradition behind the poetry of happiness. You know what I mean?
No, it has a tendency to quickly be associated with satire.
Yeah, and he was not, he had that ability. He could do pretty much anything in his poems, but he was not a satirist, and he was not sour on human prospects, and he wasn't sour on other people. He seemed to genuinely enjoy and take pleasure in daily life, just very much like Frank O'Hara did.
Yeah, kind of invented or took much further the romantic notions of recalling the past. There's a profound nostalgia in his poems. Certainly the circus, which we're going to get to,
yeah,
the second circus, is very much a poem of nostalgia and examining his life. He says in some poem, I've reconstructed my life so many times now that now my life is four-fifths reconstruction, something like that. So memory for him was, even though it is nostalgic, it is a marker of what is gone and gone forever, it's still a sort of joyous, even youthful activity in his work because it never shuts down possibilities. It keeps opening things up. And there is a great emotional range in his poems. I find that his poem, his great poem with Janice, to be amazingly, amazingly sad. But while it's being sad, it is also just offering us delight after delight. You know, if it's possible that there is a great poet who is not interested in Duende, it's Kenneth Cope.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned his youthfulness. I recorded him just 2 years before he died, or a year and a half before he died, and he still sounded incredibly youthful. He still sounded like somebody in his 20s.
Yes, you can listen to recordings of him reading poems 20, 25 years apart and barely be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, the poem we're going to hear was recorded in the 1970s, and we have a couple of his poems, have him reading his poems up on our website, poetryfoundation.org. And before we did this podcast, I asked you to choose which one you would like to talk about. And you chose two, but one of them was The Circus. Well, tell me why you chose this particular poem.
Well, it's so beautiful, and it's quite a gutsy thing to write a poem about writing a poem.
Yeah, that is the subject of the poem. But he's writing about a poem he wrote previously, also called The Circus.
Right, and then it keeps going, and it becomes an examination of acts of memory. of, you know, emotion recollected in tranquility. And it seems to me to be extremely graceful and moving.
Yeah, it's also quite long. It's one of the longer poems we've ever done on the podcast, but it totally holds up. Let me just play the introduction that he gave to a live audience.
About 15 years ago or 16 years ago, I wrote a poem called The Circus, which is in my book, Thank You, which, you know, the way poets sometimes really have in their minds an idea of what's the best poem they ever wrote. And I always thought The Circus was the best poem I ever wrote for a while. I don't anymore. I like this one just as much. And I was thinking about the time I wrote the poem, and it reminded me about a whole long time when I was married and lived in Paris the time I wrote the poem. A lot of people's names are in this poem. Some of them are friends of mine, and others are probably be well known to you.
So let's listen to it. Here's Kenneth Koch reading The Circus.
I remember when I wrote The Circus, I was living in Paris. Or rather, we were living in Paris, Janice. Frank was alive. The Whitney Museum was still on 8th Street, or was it still something else? Fernand Léger lived in our building. Well, it wasn't really our building. It was the building we lived in, next to a Grand Guignol troupe who made a lot of noise. So that one day I yelled through a hole in the wall of our apartment. I don't know why there was a hole there. Shut up! And the voice came back to me saying something. I don't know what. Once I saw Léger walk out of the building, I think. Stanley Kunitz came to dinner. I wrote The Circus in two tries, the first getting most of the first stanza. That fall, I also wrote an opera libretto called Louisa or Matilda. Jean-Claude came to dinner. He said, about cocktail sauce, it should be good on something, but not on these, oysters. By that time, I think I had already written The Circus. Part of the inspiration came while walking to the post office one night. And I wrote a big segment of The Circus when I came back, having been annoyed to have to go. I forget what I went there about. You were back in the apartment. What a dump. Actually, we liked it, I think. With your hair and your writing and the pans moving strummingly about the kitchen. And I wrote The Circus. It was a summer night. No, it was an autumn one. Summer when I remember it, but actually no, autumn. That black dusk toward the post office. And I wrote many other poems then, but The Circus was the best. Maybe not by far the best. Geography was also wonderful. And the Airplane Betty poems inspired by you, but The Circus was the best. Sometimes I feel I actually am the person who did this, who wrote that, including that poem, The Circus. But sometimes, on the other hand, I don't. There are so many factors engaging our attention. At every moment, the happiness of others, the health of those we know, and our own. And the millions upon millions of people we don't know, and their well-being to think about. So it seems strange I found time to write The Circus and even spent two evenings on it, and that I have also the time to remember that I did it and remember you and me then and write this poem about it. At the beginning of the circus girls are rushing through the night in the circus wagons, and tulips and other flowers will be picked a long time from now. This poem wants to get off on its own someplace like a painting, not held to a depiction of composing The Circus. Noel Lee was in Paris then, but usually out of it, in Germany or Denmark, giving a concert as part of an endless activity, which was either his career or his happiness or a combination of both or neither. I remember his dark eyes looking. He was nervous with me, perhaps because of our days at Harvard. It is understandable enough to be nervous with anybody. How softly and easily one feels one alone, love of one's friends, when one is commanding the time and space syndrome, if that's the right word, which I doubt. But together, how come one is so nervous? One is not always. But what was I then, and what am I now attempting to create, if create is the right word, out of this combination of experience and aloneness? And who are you telling me it is or is not a poem, not you? Go back with me, though, to those nights I was writing The Circus. Do you like that poem? Have you read it? It is in my book, Thank You, which Grove just reprinted. I wonder how long I'm going to live and what the rest will be like. I mean the rest of my life. John Cage said to me the other night, "How old are you?" And I told him, 46. Since then, I've become 47. He said, "Oh, that's a great age. I remember." John Cage once told me he didn't charge much for his mushroom identification course at the New School because he didn't want to make a profit from nature. He was ahead of his time. I was behind my time. We were both in time. Brilliant. Go to the head of the class. And time is a river. It doesn't seem like a river to me. It seemed like an unformed plan. Days go by and still nothing is decided about what to do until you know it never will be. And then you say, time. But you really don't care much about it anymore. Time means something when you have the major part of yours ahead of you, as I did in Aix-en-Provence. That was 3 years before I wrote The Circus. That year I wrote Bricks and The Great Atlantic Railway. I felt time surround me like a blanket, endless and soft. I could go to sleep endlessly and wake up and still be in it. But I treasured secretly the part of me that was individually changing. Like Noah Lee, I was interested in my career. And still am. But now it is like a town I don't want to leave. Not a tower I'm climbing, opposed by ferocious enemies. I never mentioned my friends in my poems at the time I wrote The Circus, although they meant almost more than anything to me. Of this now, for some time, I felt an attenuation, so I'm mentioning them. Maybe this will bring them back to me. Not them, perhaps, but what I felt about them. John Ashbery, Jane Freilicher, Larry Rivers, Frank O'Hara. Their names alone bring tears to my eyes, as seeing Polly did last night. It is beautiful at any time, but the paradox is leaving it in order to feel it. When you've come back, the sun has declined and the people are merrier, or else they've gone home altogether, and you are left alone. Well, you put up with that. Your sureness is like the sun while you have it, but when you don't, it lacks a black and icy night. I came home and wrote The Circus that night, Janice. I didn't come and speak to you and put my arm around you and ask you if you'd like to take a walk or go to the Cirque Medrano, though that's what I wrote poems about, and I'm writing about that now, and now I'm alone. And this is not as good a poem as The Circus, and I wonder if any good will come of either of them all the same. Thank you.
That was Kenneth Koch reading The Circus on November 15th, 1976 at the Library of Congress. Now, Dean, he skirts a line. How does he keep this poem? It's deeply nostalgic, as you said, but how does he keep this poem from falling into a kind of bathos? It could have really drowned somewhere in there in his memories.
Yeah, I think it's because of the way the poem fishtails a lot, how things at times seem to slightly come from nowhere.
Yeah.
But they're united by a meditative slowness. This is one of his slower poems, too, and I think it allows it to make sort of sideways excursions in the poem while retaining its meditative clarity and coherence.
And some of those excursions are moving in themselves. The whole little commentary on his career, how important it is to him, how he felt like it was a citadel when he was younger that he had to attack.
I was interested in my career, and still am. But now it is like a town I don't want to leave, not a tower I'm climbing, opposed by ferocious enemies.
I think that is a pivotal moment in the poem, because it is in some ways him saying, you know, my youth as an artist, that sort of combative avant-garde energy that a young artist needs is to some extent behind him now.
Yeah. Kenneth Koch died in 2002. How do you think his reputation is holding up?
To some extent, I think it's quite strong now. There was a period where I feel like he was frankly being neglected. He was, you know, taken out of some of the anthologies. But then, you know, he comes back and boy, does he, you know, the last decade of his life, what he produced is just extraordinary. Not only in volume, but accomplishment. His last books are just great.
Yeah.
And they're full of just, you know, unforgettable poems.
Now, if you weren't on a cell phone, I think I would ask you to read your elegy to him. Which I believe it is to him, isn't it? Elegy on Toy Piano? Is that to Kenneth?
Yeah, it is.
This is a breaking convention on this show to actually have a poem read over the phone. Do you want to give it a shot?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, the thing, you know, I mean, I felt kind of obligated and a need, a real felt need to write a kind of elegy for Kenneth. It was a real bind because I felt like, well, you know, this has got to be like the greatest poem I could possibly write. And then I realized it was just, well, just dial it back completely and just try to go back to a kind of simplicity and first-mindedness, that nearly naive joy and connection to the art.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of where this poem is coming from. Elegy on Toy Piano. You don't need a pony to connect you to the unseeable, or an airplane to connect you to the sky. Necessary it is to die if you are a living thing, which you have no choice about. Necessary it is to love, to live, and there are many manuals, but in all important ways, one is on one's own. You need not cut off your hand, no need to eat a bouquet. Your head becomes a peach pit, your tongue a honeycomb. Necessary it is to live, to love. Charge into the burning tower, then charge back out. And necessary it is to die. Even for the grass, even for the pony connecting you to what can't be grasped. The injured gazelle falls behind the herd, one last wild enjambment. Because of the sores in his mouth, the great poet struggles with a dumpling. His work has enlarged the world, but the world is about to stop including him. He is the tower the world runs out of. When something becomes ash, there's nothing you can do to turn it back. About this, even diamonds do not lie.
Din Young, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Curtis.
Din Young's latest book is The Art of Recklessness, Poetry as Assertive Force and Contradiction, published by Grey Wolf Press. His book of poems, Elegy on Toy Piano, is dedicated to Kenneth Cook. You can read the title poem from the book on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Let us know what you think of this program, where our motto is...
Tie me to the bed. Use the rope.
Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.